You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In 1975, FBI Special Agent Joe Pistone went undercover as Donnie the Jeweler Brasco and infiltrated the New York Mafia. He spent the next 6 years gathering information that would ultimately lead to the conviction of over 200 mobsters. And a book based on his story became a New York Times bestseller. And then there was the hit movie starring Al Pacino and Johnny Depp. Now Joe's written a follow-up that includes details he was unable to reveal previously because of all the pending mafia trials. Donnie Brasco, Unfinished Business, is published by Running Press and was written with the help of Charles Brandt. I'm very pleased that it brings both of the authors to my show today. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Joe, why did you want to write the second book? Did you feel obligated to finally disclose everything that you'd had to keep secret?
Well, yes, I did, and I felt an obligation to bring the readers of my previous book, My Undercover Life in the Mafia, to a conclusion of what happened to the New York Mafia during the 90s and the early 2000s.
Charles, weren't you once a district attorney in Delaware? Were there legal issues involved in the writing of this book, too?
Well, actually, there were, although... The writing was an adventure, mafia story after mafia story with Joe. But, you know, Joe had to be careful when he was undercover because there were certain times when he had to be involved in crimes, and that was unauthorized by the FBI, unauthorized by the local authorities, and he couldn't be the only Boy Scout on the in the crew in order to pass as Donnie Brasco.
So he wasn't granted immunity to any crimes that he might have had to have committed?
Not only didn't he have immunity legally, the FBI itself administratively would have hung him out to dry as a rogue agent if he got caught doing something illegal.
Well, but at the same time, you were undercover as a member of the mob, or at least a potential member of the mob. You'd have to commit crimes, wouldn't you? And they understood that.
Oh, exactly. I mean, there are certain crimes you are permitted to commit because otherwise, you know, why are you there? The mafia or any other criminal organization doesn't need you if you're not going to be an earner, if you're not going to be a moneymaker. But there are certain things that you cannot do. You can't get involved in violence, you know, except if you're going to protect yourself or protect a citizen. And that's there were instances where, for one instance, there were a couple guys that robbed myself and a wise guy, and they wanted these guys found to get killed. Well, you know, I had to make a decision. I said, well, I'll take care of it for you. Now, in order not to get these guys killed, you know, I have to, you know, smack them around, give them a beating. So you have to make that split second judgment. Do I see these guys get killed, or do I handle it and do something that I wouldn't normally do?
And you had to come up with all sorts of stories to protect yourself when they expected you to engage in an activity that was unacceptable.
Well, sure.
I mean, you say well-told fiction.
Well-told fiction.
But we'll get to this later. It's when you almost had no choice that you had to pull out of the undercover activity.
Yes, what happened was is that there was a shooting war within the Bonanno family, and the faction that I was with, that was in control of the family, had murdered three top-ranking bosses that were trying to take over the family, and I had been given a contract to kill an individual that was due to get killed, and you have to accept the contract because if you don't, you're going to get killed. So, but luckily the individual was on the lam. He knew there was a hit out on him, so he was in hiding.
But so, weren't you close to being a made man at this point?
Yes, I was.
And if you had done the killing, would you have been made?
Well, I had already been proposed for membership, and whether I had done the killing or not, I was going to become a made guy when they had the inductions.
But you had to drop out because of the problem that the dilemma that this posed. Now, what would have happened if you'd become a made man? Could you really have done much more than you already did?
Yes, if I had become a made man, I could have done much more because I would have had the ability to sit down with individuals from the other crime families without one of my Bonanno guys with me. So I would have, you know, I would have been able to have sit downs again with individuals of the other four families, gain other intelligence information regarding these families.
So it might have been tempting for you to have committed this crime. After all, it was against a bad guy anyway, and become a made man.
Well, you know, if. That wouldn't have made me, you know, do it. The only thing that would make you do it is that you have to have a mindset. You know, you have to protect yourself. When you're in a deep cover situation, the only one that's going to save your life is yourself. And knowing that if you don't do certain things, you're going to get killed. And you know, most of the time, you don't have the ability to pick up a telephone and, you know, and call the FBI, and you say, well, you know, am I going to get killed or is a gangster going to get killed? And you have to make that decision.
Charles, some years ago, I talked to a man who was in the witness protection program. He had squealed on Joe Colombo, who had worked out of his father's real estate office, and this guy committed all sorts of crimes on the side. And he was protected by the fact that he was an informant for the FBI. Finally, when he testified, he had to go on the witness protection program, but he never was arrested for any of the robberies he was involved with or any of the other crimes that he committed.
Well, you know, it's a matter of balance. If you're going to get chemotherapy and radiation, you're liable to lose your hair, you're liable to suffer some side effects, but at the same time, you're killing the cancer. So the prosecutor has to make the decision. Is it worth it? Do we let this guy slide in return for getting the cancer? And, you know, when Joe was talking about the decision, split-second decisions, when they order you to kill somebody, there is no such thing as no. There is no such thing as I'll think about it. Mm-hmm. You go and do it right then, or they'll kill you on the spot.
So at that point, you had to...
Well, you have to accept the contract, sure. Now...
You didn't.
I didn't kill him. Of course not. Now, in my head, am I going to go out and just kill him? Of course not. You're not going to do that. You're going to try to locate him. If you're by yourself, you know, the FBI will come in, snatch him, save his life. The dilemma comes when, you know, you're in a situation where the guy's located. You're with the other gangsters. And then what happens? And, you know, you have to make a decision now. Is he going to die or am I going to die?
How did you become an FBI agent?
Well, I always wanted to be in law enforcement. I always wanted to be a cop. I got appointed to the police force when I was a senior in college, but I couldn't go through the academy because I wanted to finish my last year in college. So I finished my last year and went into Naval Intelligence, spent 3 years in Naval Intelligence, and then when my tour was up of duty there, I applied to the FBI.
And was the Naval Intelligence a good preparation for what you wound up doing?
Yes, it was, because I needed the work experience and I needed the investigative experience to get into the FBI, and it gave me good investigative experience.
My guests are Joe Pistone and Charles Brandt. The book, Donnie Brasco, Unfinished Business, Shocking Declassified Details from the FBI's Greatest Undercover Operation and a Bloody Timeline of the Fall of the Mafia. It's published by Running Press. That's the longest subtitle I think I've ever read. Had you done undercover operations before you infiltrated the Mafia?
Yes, I had done several undercover operations. Prior to the one, this infiltration, I had come off... one that was over a year and a half, just about a year and a half operation, where I was involved with a crew of guys that we were going up and down the East Coast stealing high-priced automobiles. They were you came to us and said, "Look, I want a Cadillac. What color you want? I want you know, a black Cadillac with white interior, whatever." And we'd go out and hook it.
How long do you have to do that before you get the guys arrested?
We did that. Well, we were stealing. They were stealing other stuff too. We were stealing heavy equipment. I think we hooked maybe one or two airplanes. That was, like I said, that, and that year and a half was preparation and plus the operation.
And you were picked because you're an Italian-American or because the mobsters thought that you had the eyes of a killer?
Well, in this operation, I was picked because I was an Italian, and I grew up in Paterson, New Jersey, and I grew up in a Italian neighborhood. Being Italian, mafia influence in the neighborhood, and I just happened to be a good street agent. Up until that point in time, and my other undercover operations were successful. So I was asked if I would take on the assignment, and I did.
But you had no idea of the scope of this assignment when you started and how successful it would be, but also, I'm sure, how it would change your life.
No idea of the scope at all. I mean, it was slotted for 6 months, and we ended up going 6 years. Never dreamed that I would infiltrate to the point where I would be proposed for a made guy, no.
How did you get your first introduction to the Cosa Nostra?
Well, it took me about 8 months, a little over 8 months, of just frequenting different bars and restaurants that we had targeted. It was a 7-day-a-week job. Finally, after about 8 months, I start talking to a bartender in one of the places I hung out in. And, you go through the whole dance.
But what are you telling them? You're saying, I'd like to commit crimes?
No.
I'd like to be connected?
No. After you get talking, after you get into conversation, what I actually did was I never said a word about committing crimes. After I felt that I had a good rapport with this guy, one night I brought in some diamonds, and I just laid them on the bar, and I said, "Look, I got some diamonds here. I need X amount of money. You think you can offer them?" And it's the language you use, how you conduct yourself, and the guy, with that, the guy knows that, the guy's probably a jewel thief.
Mm-hmm. So and that's how you became Donnie Brasco, the jeweler.
Yeah, exactly.
But your book tries to make clear that these are really cold-blooded killers. These people in the mob. Do you feel that the Godfather, Goodfellas, and so many of the other popular culture depictions of them humanize them too much?
Well, I think The Godfather did. I think Goodfellas, Donnie Brasco, shows them exactly what they are. I mean, you're dealing with guys that are thieves, killers. Look, when you kill your best friend, you get an order to kill your best friend and you do it. And then to dispose of the body, you cut them up with a chainsaw. I mean, that's pretty gruesome.
Yeah. You were very closely associated with Lefty Ruggiero and Sonny Black. They were kind of combined into one character in
the movie.
Yeah.
Correct.
Who were they?
Lefty Ruggiero was actually the second Bonanno guy that I hooked up with. The first guy I hooked up with in the Bonannos was a guy by the name of Tony Mira. He eventually introduced me to Lefty Ruggiero, who became my mentor and partner in the mafia, and Sonny Black was our captain.
And you were the best man at Lefty's wedding. So did you really become friends, or was this all part of what you were doing as an undercover agent?
Well, most of it was, what I was doing as an undercover agent. But you're with somebody 7 days a week, and I was, we were the age where I was young enough to be a son at that time. The guy was a gangster, but he had a grandson that he loved, so, and he had three daughters that he loved. But you have to separate who they are and what they're doing, and you have to always maintain that, hey, you're dealing with gangsters.
Well, they're real people. They have families, but at the same time, some of the things they're doing, as you say, cutting up your own buddy after you've killed him, that is not the sort of thing we want our best friends to be doing.
Well, exactly. And, like I say, what you have to keep focused on why you're there. And you're not there to try to rehabilitate them when you see the side of them that is with their real family. You have to remember you're there to gather evidence against them, take them to trial, the side of them that are gangsters.
I'm talking with Joe Pistone, the real-life Donnie Brasco, and with Charles Brandt, his collaborator in a new book called Donnie Brasco, Unfinished Business. It is published by Running Press, and we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with the real-life Donnie Brasco, Joe Pistone, and with the collaborator of his new book called Donnie Brasco, Unfinished Business, published by Running Press. So there you were. You got yourself into the mob through this as a jeweler, as a guy who steals jewelry. But you gained their trust rather quickly. Did they not have any suspicion that somebody like you might be a cop? In the movies, they always do.
Well, they don't. It's not suspicions of cop. It's suspicion of being an informant. And yes, in the early stages when I first started hanging around with these guys, I was followed back to my apartment. I had an apartment up at 92nd and 3rd Ave. And guys followed me, from the neighborhood back to make sure that I lived where I said I lived. A couple times, I'd leave Little Italy and I'd go somewhere to grab a bite to eat uptown, and somebody beyond me, they check you out.
So Little Italy is really the place that everybody hung out.
Well, Little Italy, and then with Sonny Black Napolitano, we hung out in Brooklyn on Graham and Withers and at the Motion Lounge in Brooklyn.
But I remember John Gotti used to have an office, a club, on Mulberry Street. So would I assume that those guys who were standing on that street, who had bulges on one side of their suit and were counting off big wads of dollar bills, were probably mob connected?
Well, if they were standing in front of one of the social clubs, they were mob connected.
We mentioned earlier that you had to commit some crimes. What kind of crimes? How much leeway did you have?
Well, you're not really supposed to. And the reason why I took a jeweler, my legend as a jeweler, because it's really not a there's not many jewel thieves that are in the can for murder. They're not. It's not a violent crime, and you can do it yourself.
But there's still a lot of money involved.
But there's still a lot of money involved. I mean, I was involved in narcotics traffic with these guys, illegal gambling business with these guys. So the problem is when you're in this type of situation, whatever crimes that they're involved in, chances are that the undercover is going to be, get involved in them also.
Well, you write in this book about other officers who've been caught in this kind of activity. There's the case against FBI agent Lynn DeVecchio, and then there are those former New York City police officers Louis Eppolito and Stephen Caracappa. Do you think that they had good excuses, that they were just working undercover?
Well, in the matter of the two cops, they weren't really working undercover. They were, on the payroll of the mob. With Lynn DelVecchio, by the way, who was a very dear friend, these are allegations made by mobsters that are trying to buy their way out of a long sentence. So that case is still going through the court system as far as with motions to dismiss. I've known Lynn for, 30 years. I know some of the circumstances, and, like I say, that's mobsters just making allegations to buy themselves a better deal.
You reveal that anyone who was close to you was going to be killed once it came out that you were FBI undercover. Did that bother you in the case of Sonny and Lefty?
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, look, my job was to put people in jail. My job wasn't to get people killed. But on the other hand, when you're in the mafia, two things are always on your mind. Do I go to jail today or do I get killed today? And being that these guys were close to me, and that's the law of the mafia, that if you vouch for somebody and he turns out to be an informant or a cop, you're going to get killed.
How can you live a life like that, knowing that you could be arrested or killed at any time? Is the money that great that it makes the trade-off worthwhile?
At times, the money's great, but it's the culture. You know, that's what it is. It's the mindset of these guys. They grew up in that environment, and you know, most of these guys, their fathers were wise guys. Maybe their uncles are wise guys. Their brothers are also wise guys.
Or they may be married to somebody.
They're married to somebody. So it's that culture, and you know, it's the thrill of getting over, not going to work, getting the money, and then when you become involved, you know, really caught up with it, the mafia is number one in your life. Everything else is secondary.
So what happened when you had to come out as an FBI man? Did you talk to Sonny Black and Lefty Ruggiero?
Yes. What happened was I didn't actually talk to him. What happened was that three agents, that one of them who knew Sonny Black well, went to see him and to advise him that, you know, that, hey, Donnie Brasco is really an undercover FBI agent. And Sonny's reaction was, well, if I see him now, I'll know.
He wasn't afraid that he'd be killed?
He knew it.
Was there a possibility that he would have turned?
Well, that was the reason they went to see him. They wanted to give him the chance, you know, because he knew that once it came out that he would be. He didn't want to come over. So he actually was killed 17 days later. Lefty Ruggiero was on his way to a sit-down, a meeting, where the FBI had information that he was going to get killed at that meeting. And fortunately, they had surveillance agents on the street, and they snatched him up and saved his life.
But he didn't turn either.
No, he didn't turn either. Sonny Black, they eventually killed. Lefty, the Bureau saved his life. He spent 15 years in jail. Tony Mira, the first Bonanno that I met, they ended up killing him.
So people who were associated with you really did die.
Unfortunately, yes.
Sonny Black had his hands cut off because of his as symbolic of his having Joe shake hands,
introducing me to Bob, my boss.
Did he reveal his real feelings about you at around this time?
Yeah, Sonny had there was a lady friend that he had told that, and I had conversation with her after that. I really loved that kid. He said, and that, you know, he said he was doing his job. And he did it better than we did. Yeah, he beat us. And, you know, he said, there's nothing we can do about it.
Well, that's really philosophical. Now, none of these cases could have been made without RICO. In the past, is RICO and the RICO laws what really has done in the mob?
Bigger than penicillin. RICO is what the tool that was used to do in the mob. And the evidence that was gathered by Joe during those 6 years is literally what did in the mob.
But it's a complicated thing, and you have to convince juries that you have to explain to juries what it is all about.
Well, that's where Joe came in, because Joe was on the inside, and RICO stands for Racketeer Influence Corrupt Organization. And if you can prove that a guy committed certain crimes as part of that kind of organization, a mafia, let's say, and if you can prove the hierarchy of that mafia, and they couldn't prove that in the past. When Joe got in there for 6 years and hung out with these people, he could give chapter and verse of who was who, where they fit in, how the corporation was structured, you know, what a consigliere was, what an underboss was, things we now know and take for granted Joe had to teach us.
And weren't there people who actually were denying that any of this was the case? They said it was just a bunch of disorganized criminals.
Oh my God. While Joe was undercover and while Rudy Giuliani was trying to prosecute these cases, and while the Organized Crime Task Force of the state of New York was instrumental in helping put these cases together, the governor, Mario Cuomo, was denying publicly that there was such a thing as a mafia. He called it a bunch of baloney.
And why do you think he did? Because he didn't want to believe that of Italian-Americans?
Well, I grew up in Brooklyn. I went to Brooklyn Law School, and my opinions as to why Mario Cuomo did what he did are not going to be revealed by me ever.
not even in the third Donnie Brasco book?
Not ever. It's just speculation on my part. That's why I wouldn't say anything further.
Well, Rudy Giuliani was one of the prosecutors involved in this case. A number of them went on to become pretty famous.
Oh, yeah. Rudy was actually the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. He oversaw and administered all the cases. Michael Chertoff was the lead prosecutor in the commission case. Of course, Michael Chertoff went on to be a federal judge. Then he went on Secretary of Homeland Security. Louis Freeh was one of the prosecutors.
Head of the FBI later.
Went on to be a federal judge, FBI, head of the FBI. Barbara Jones, one of the prosecutors, now a federal judge in the Southern District. So a lot of the people in that were in the prosecutorial phase of it all went on to higher positions.
Is that because all of the defendants in the first trial were convicted?
Well, that and the following trials, there were, we had the commission case where all the commission was indicted, the Pizza Connection case, the big narcotics case with the Bananos and the Sicilians. So I think it was a combination of all the cases that followed plus the initial case.
My guests are Joe Pistone, author of the New York Times bestseller Donnie Brasco, My Undercover Life in the Mafia. Now co-author with Charles Brandt of Donnie Brasco, Unfinished Business, which is published by Running Press. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So let's talk about a couple of those cases, the Pizza Connection case. What did that involve? You said that was a drug case?
Well, that was a major, major importation case of drugs into the United States, cocaine into the United States by the Sicilian Mafia.
Who were the Zips?
The Zips were the Sicilians.
Why were they called Zips?
You know, there's all kind of backstories because they, they're lethal killers. Some say because they talk fast, but I never heard it. I never heard that one. My understanding was always because of they were lethal killers. And I think, I can't remember how many defendants right now, but it was a 30-some in there.
Pizza Connection, yeah.
Yeah.
Eventually, it dwindled down to 28, I think.
But it was at the time the longest trial in history.
And the most expensive.
And the most expensive, which ended up in almost everybody getting convicted. And during the course of the case, one individual got murdered.
They started fighting with each other.
They started fighting with each other. The attorneys, was squabbling amongst the attorneys. But eventually everybody got, most of them got convicted. I think they lost maybe one or two fringe players. And it pretty much knocked out the drug importation by the Bananos at the time.
And Charles, the judge applied the federal restitution law in a unique way.
Yeah, that was really quite interesting. He decided that the damage that they did spread out through the culture in the form of drug addiction, and that drug addiction is a disease, and you need rehab, and you need medicine for it. And he put a multi-million dollar figure on some of the top people to get some of their earnings into the healthcare system for drug addicts. And it was a wonderful idea, but it was overturned on appeal that he exceeded his authority.
Now, how much of the stuff in this book is based on the declassified documents?
Well, everything that involves what Joe did that nobody knows he did, that's all based on
that. You couldn't tell that in the first book.
No.
Exactly, because there are ongoing trials, and we knew that there were other trials coming up.
I mean, you have to remember that hijacking is actually armed robbery. It's a crime of violence. It's a serious offense, both in state courts and in federal courts. Burglaries of warehouses. And once you go in and you find guards there and you put handcuffs on them, again, you're committing the crime of robbery. And, you're really... It was a touchy situation for Joe at the time. He had to do certain things, and a very touchy situation for him when he wrote this first book, no doubt. The statute of limitations had yet to expire.
Oh, so you had to wait until the statute of limitations had expired before you could do this, because you could have been, you could be in jail even though you were an FBI undercover agent?
Well, I'm sure, you know, if you commit certain crimes and you know, some people take offense to it.
Or somebody wants to make a name for himself.
Yeah.
I mean, look, when you look at what's happening to Lynn DeVecchio, what he was a handler for a mafia informant named Greg Scarpa. And Lynn had to make certain decisions about the handling of Greg Scarpa. And now they've indicted Lynn for murder, claiming that the decisions he made led to the deaths of people.
Now, you mentioned earlier the Mafia Commission case, which really laid out the way the mob is organized. And that one was also successfully prosecuted. Was it just about the New York mob that you were involved with? Because aren't the families of the mob that are in other parts of the country structured pretty much the same way?
Well, they're all structured the same.
So did that really affect what was going on in Arizona or in Las Vegas or in Chicago or L.A.?
Yes, it did, because although, you know, there are approximately, you know, maybe 27 different mafia families throughout the United States, but the New York is the controlling city, and everybody defers to New York, and New York has had the ability, you know, the commission had the ability to tell individuals in Detroit Kansas City or Los Angeles how to run their affairs.
Then we have Boston. We've got Boston, and that was the site of The Departed, this new Martin
Patriot.
Scorsese film.
Yeah.
Did that film strike you as being accurate? Because it's based on a Hong Kong movie.
Yeah, I mean, which was a terrific movie. I think they took, they made Jack Nicholson an Irish gentleman, and I would take it that he was supposed to be Whitey Bulger, the head of the Irish, the Irish mob up there. But yeah, it was based on a Hong Kong movie.
You're in the movie business. That's the only reason I ask you. You've gone from one set of crooks to another, as far as I can tell, because whenever people get a percentage of the profits, they complain that they never get any money. A contract was put on your life, wasn't it?
Yes, when unfortunately in the U.S., undercovers have to testify under their true name and face their accusers.
In some other countries, they actually sit behind a screen.
Yeah, all countries overseas that are engaged in undercover work, their undercovers either can they testify under their undercover name behind the screen, or they give an affidavit to the judge, and that's their testimony.
So did you have to go into hiding? And when Salman Rushdie had the fatwa, he had to go hiding for years, and it affected his marriage at the time.
Yes, we moved either five or six times. Of course, I had the luxury of having the FBI behind me as far as my security, but you still have to build up a background for your wife and your kids. So, like I say, we moved five or six times, changed names a few times for the children. You know, enrolled them in different schools under different names.
Do you think
because there was a contract out on me? Yeah.
Do you think the statute of limitations is over on that as well?
Well, we've never heard that they rescinded it, but you know, today I don't think anybody's going to get up tomorrow morning and say, "Well, I'm going out looking for Joe today." But you know, you don't know you know some guy that's a cowboy that thinks he's, "Hey, if I take out Donnie Brasco, I'm going to make a name for myself."
Well, it's interesting that you really laid out how the mob worked, and since then, pretty much everything that we've heard about it, whether it's the fictional things like The Sopranos or some of the other movies about the mob or nonfiction books, they all are based on that. Do you feel like you really have changed the way we understand the mob?
I think so, because what I think what we've done is shown that it's not invincible. You know, it's not this this organization with this aura about it that can't be penetrated, and that they're above everybody else.
There was an article in the Times the other day that suggested that most of the mobsters these days are kind of old.
Well, most of the guys that you know of our era, they are. They're either in jail or they passed on, or you know, they can't conduct any more business.
But you think there are young guys who are just as excited about joining the mob today as they would have been 20 or 30 years ago?
Well, sure. You know, look, you're going to eliminate it. You're never going to eliminate it because you have guys that want to be gangsters. You know, they don't want to work. They want money today, yesterday, and not go, you know, punch in and get a paycheck at the end of the week. So, these guys today, you know, they're wannabe gangsters. They don't have the wherewithal, the old timers.
I want to thank you both so much for being with us. Joe Pistone, also known as Donnie Brasco, the latest book, Donnie Brasco, Unfinished Business. He's here with his co-author, Charles Brandt. The book is published by Running Press. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so very much.